just 14% of Illinois school children who qualify for free or reduced lunch at school get those same meals once school is out.
We know that the kids that usually get lunch every day at school, once school's out, not really sure how they're eating. So at least we know here they're getting a meal every day for lunch.
The problem isn't necessarily access to food. It's also what type of food they're getting if they're not in a school lunch program.
These are the best American oranges ever because I had them in kindergarten and they're so good. I love them.
Today we find out how schools, food banks, and other groups are trying to solve this problem. Also, how a new law headed to President Obama's desk may help reporters and others trying to get access to federal information. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 20% of children in Illinois have families who worry about where their next meal will come from. In the summer, when school's out, that problem is much worse. While schools give free or reduced lunches and breakfasts to many students, just 14% of those children are able to access meals to programs during the summer. And that challenge is even bigger when we're talking about rural areas. Today on the 21st, we're going to talk about what's driving the problem and what's being done to get healthy meals to children during the summer. There are 28 counties in Illinois that don't have any official summer sites where school children can get meals. That's less than 30% of the state. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking about that program and what campaigns like No Kid Hungry are doing to change that. But first, earlier, we visited a program where children are getting meals in East Central Illinois. The 21st Ben Thomas Payne went to Danville and brought us back this audio postcard from the Boys and Girls Club of Danville.
Today, we're eating oranges, drinking milk, grapes, and a pancake on a stick with syrup and a cheese stick.
These are the best American oranges ever because I had them in kindergarten and they're so good. I love them.
These are the best food ever.
My name is Marvelline Stovall. I'm a food service worker here at the Boys and Girls Club. We know that the kids that usually get lunch every day at school, once school's out, not really sure how they're eating, so at least we know here they're getting a meal every day for lunch.
So we have to have a balanced meal. So there has to be a certain amount of protein, grains, two servings of fruit and or vegetable, and milk as well. I am Rob Gifford, the executive director of the Boys and Girls Club. For our kids that are here at the club, it's an opportunity for them to have a lunch every single day, which a lot of times during the summer may not be the case for them if they're not at the club. And it's also open to the community for kids that are ages 6 through 18 that can come into the club and get a free lunch as well.
The grapes are good and sour.
I am Kalia Mason, and I work in the kitchen at the Boys and Girls Club. My favorite part is when the kids come in and they say, hi, Kalia, and they ask me to go on the activities with them, and they're happy to see me.
Don't forget to hold your tray with both hands, okay?
That's the scene from one summer lunch program at the Boys and Girls Club of Dansville. As I said, there's 28 counties in Illinois that don't have any official summer sites like that program where school children can get meals. Joining us to talk about this issue on the phone from Springfield is Naomi Green. She's a principal consultant for the nutrition and wellness programs with the Illinois State Board of Education. Naomi, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having us.
And joining us from Chicago is Susie Lee. She's the program manager for No Kid Hungry. Hi, Susie. Thanks for being here as well.
Hi, I agree. Thank you for having us.
Susie, we heard that percentage about school children. One in five school children is eligible for assistance, but I guess that number hides the fact that the problem in the summer is much worse because 14% of the children who do qualify are actually able to use programs. What are some of the problems just as you see statewide with summer and children and access to healthy meals?
Absolutely. You know, one of the biggest things with the summer meals program is transportation and awareness. So one of the ways that No Kid Hungry works with the USDA and the State Board of Education to support this program is to provide grants for new and innovative ways to feed and reach kids across the state. We see nearly 90 applications a summer asking for assistance to help feed kids across the state, and most of those are asking for transportation. No Kid Hungry in other states has seen kids riding their bicycle up to 7 miles to get to a summer meal site, and that's too much for children. We need to make sure they have access to healthy food safely.
Susie, when you say applications, who are those applications made by? Are they made by social service agencies or individual people?
The applications can come from almost any nonprofit organization. So this is one of the great things about the Summer Meals program is a school can host a summer meal site. A public library can host a summer meal site. Boys and Girls Club, you had that great audio postcard. They're a wonderful partner. YMCA's, the list goes on and on of potential partners.
Naomi, I wonder if you can explain how it works for schools. And maybe we should start with how it works for during the school year so people understand. During the school year, how does a school learn about a child who needs help or who qualifies?
Right. So the school districts they're right there at the front lines of helping and working with kids. So they're the first ones that see children that may need assistance, and kids turn in, families turn in household income applications. So basically any child that is receiving breakfast or lunch, the schools are familiar with these kids, and they know which ones will be designated to receive a free meal or a reduced price meal or a low cost paid meal, even though the children that pay for their meals, it's very low cost. But so we already know what the number of kids are across the state who are eligible to receive free meals. So, yeah, so we're familiar with children who are receiving these meals during the school year. And even after school, there are programs that help these kids. But then when the school year ends, unless the school district continues operating and serving kids, a lot of those same children do not receive a free meal. And so No Kid Hungry has some statistics on how much the bill goes up for an average family of four. So we see that, and we see the need, and it's just about reaching those kids who need these meals.
Susie, how much does that bill go up in the summer? If you're thinking about a family of four, how much does their food cost go up if we're thinking about children who do qualify are getting either free or reduced breakfast and lunch, so two meals out of the day in school, how much does that add to food bills for families in the summer?
Absolutely. So like you said, if you're thinking of two children that are getting a free or reduced price breakfast and lunch every day, that can add up to over $360 a month. And I don't know about you, but if I had to find an extra $360 a month in my budget, I would be struggling. Mm-hmm. And these families can be really tough for them.
So, Naomi, maybe you can explain, let's take the schools piece of this first before we get into No Kid Hungry. Later, we're going to be joined by folks from the East Central Illinois Food Bank as well, for the Central Illinois Food Bank as well, for Eastern Illinois. But let's start with just the schools piece of it, because it is such a big piece during the year. There is a summer food service program. Naomi, how does that program work?
Okay, so as Susie mentioned, there's a summer food service program as well as a seamless summer option. The seamless summer option is available to schools and school districts, and it is basically what the name implies. You move from the national school lunch, and if you're going to operate in the summer, there's no paperwork. You basically move into and apply for seamless summer, and those meals count in our overall summer feeding. There is also a school mandate where schools that operate in the summer where they have 50% or more free and reduced price meal eligible children, they are required to feed those children while they're in school after so many hours. And then they're also required to promote the summer meals program to the children, so when they're leaving, they know where they may be able to find free meals if they're not participating in the summer program or if the schools aren't open.
So but the point you made there, Naomi, which I think might be an important one for people to realize, if a school district has less than 50% of its students who qualify for free or reduced lunch, they don't have to have summer sites.
Exactly. They don't. And even those that do qualify, either for whatever reason, they may not operate during the summer.
And are they not required to operate during the summer?
No, not unless they're offering an academic program they're really not required to feed kids.
So I know that, so we're thinking about counties. Last year there were 37 entire counties that didn't have any of these sites. This year we're down to 28.
We're hoping 28.
We're hoping 28.
We made inroads in six counties, and we're hoping to add a couple more. But
and how does the Illinois State Board of Education, how are you making those inroads? What are you doing to try to get different, and are these at schools or these are other sites?
Other locations and sponsors. So with the help of organizations like No Kid Hungry, Illinois Department of Public Health, the WIC organizations and sites, we've been holding information sessions around the state, as well as our trainings, and then we're also putting out information on billboards and signs which people may see as summer meals, and that's all trying to increase awareness about where children can get or find a free site. And the numbers that we'll give you later on in the program, the numbers that people can call to the hotline is through the Illinois Hunger Coalition, and or they can text Food IL to 877-877, and that's staffed by No Kid Hungry, so kids and families can find a location close to them. But if they're in a county, like one of those 28 or 30 counties that don't have a feeding site, it's very difficult.
What is the history here? Is there a reason the program was set up with central locations? It seems like it's designed more for cities than for rural areas.
And basically, that's how it works. Most of your nonprofit organizations are in urban areas. So, yes, you'll find sponsors that will take the come up to the plate and take the initiative to feed kids. So you'll have park districts, you'll have libraries, you'll have nonprofits like Catholic Charities up in Chicago or the Archdiocese Food Banks. We partner with food banks and we around the state and have them be sponsors so they can have feeding sites. So basically the model is the sponsor is the central organization, much like you would think of a school district. And then the feeding site would be like in a school district, the location where kids eat. So a school building is a feeding site. A library would be a feeding site. A park under a park district would be a feeding site.
Okay. And Susie, can you explain you said at the beginning No Kid Hungry is working to try to create more sites. And I think people might be surprised that a library would be a place where people would be able to get a meal. What other places, Susie, are you guys working on that maybe might be a non-traditional place for summer feeding programs?
One of the things that we've been particularly excited about the last couple of years is mobile food programs. So these operate similarly to a food truck, except it's part of the summer meals program. So they might stop at a parks program that doesn't have a traditional activity for the kids, but they'll have a place that kids can come and pick up meals. Or they might stop in front of a library. Hospitals are another great location. They can be, particularly in more rural communities, actually an important community center for the area.
And how often are backpacks distributed of food? Is that something that's a typical thing that happens, or is it more common that these sites are places that are offering meals that are eaten there?
These are, the program itself is designed as a congregate feeding operation, so it stems from the USDA policy, and all meals are consumed on site. So any of the backpack programs is under a totally different type of funding than this is.
Okay. Susie, are some of the mobile food trucks, is that happening now in rural locations around the state?
Unfortunately, we don't yet have very many programs, mobile programs in rural areas. It could be a great opportunity, but one of the restraints that we have is in the current regulations, that congregate meal requirement, which says that kids have to eat the meal on site. So we hope to have mobile sites that can get to more rural communities, but we're not there yet.
Naomi, is there any efforts to change that requirement? That seems like that's a big hurdle for everybody.
Well, unfortunately, that's something that would have to change in the actual the national federal act and legislation, which is under comment right now, but that, I mean, that would be something at the federal level, nothing that we could do.
Naomi, in the end, who do you think is accountable for making sure that children have access to these meals over the summers? Do you think it's up to local communities? Is it the state? Is it these federal requirements, as you just mentioned?
I would say that it would be up to the communities to ensure that kids are finding the sites or getting access to food. And I say that because it doesn't matter how much No Kid Hungry does or how much we do, if we can't find the local resources in terms of people to help make this happen, we can't do it by ourselves. And I'll give an example of Peoria, which decided to come together. The school district stepped up, but they brought churches to the plate as well as some other nonprofit organizations to decide how they were going to address the problem. And they resolved among themselves. Churches had volunteers. I said, yes, we have volunteers. Maybe they couldn't operate the program, but we've got the volunteers. The school district has the resources and the kitchens to create and make the meals and so on. And you find sites, you find communities that have the willpower to make this happen.
Thanks for that. That's Naomi Green joining us from the Illinois State Board of Education in Springfield, where she works with nutrition and wellness programs. When we come back, we are going to be talking to some local organizations, including the Eastern Illinois Food Bank's going to be joining us. Susie will stick around also from No Kid Hungry as we continue to talk about the challenge of providing programs that provide students with food over summer break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, supporting librarianship and the training of librarians, instructing instructors as they embed the library into classrooms and beyond the campus across the globe. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about the challenges of providing healthy meals to children over summer break. It's a role that schools fill during the academic year, but as we've been hearing in the summer, who is responsible for helping children have access to meals isn't as clear. We've been talking about the program with schools, but we wanted to move that conversation to food banks and other programs. In studio with me now is Teresa Brown. She's the partnership manager for Eastern Illinois Food Bank. Teresa, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me today.
And she's been working with Susie Lee, who's the programs manager for No Kid Hungry, who's still on the line with us from Chicago as well. Teresa, can you explain, I think when people think about food banks and you think about a need, people think about the holidays and they think that's when I need to bring food to a food bank because that's when people are needy. But I wonder what you see as patterns of need and how much need there is in the summer compared to the school year for you all.
Well, hunger is a 365-day issue. While it's always wonderful to have that support and generosity during the holidays, the needs really increase during the summer. We see spikes with our agency partners, with our pantries and our soup kitchens around holidays when the kids are not in school. You'll see that spike. Over summer break, you'll definitely see a spike in the needs. It was brought up before where, you know, these parents are trying to subsidize possibly $360 a month.
A month. Wow. And then I imagine when we're thinking about income and how much people, how that's a huge proportion of income for someone who, for a family facing food insecurity, which is really the issue that we're talking about.
It is. You know, many of these families are already having to make the choice of, you know, putting food on the table or paying an electric bill or buying medication, and then add on to that trying to get transportation to a site. Maybe they're working two jobs. So in the summer, the burdens just increase.
I think we have stereotypes about people who visit food banks. And I know certainly during the recession, people may not be aware that we saw a growing number of families and people who have college degrees who have problems with food insecurity, who are a growing part of the client base for a food bank. Is that still true?
it is still very true. Chances are, if you're sitting around a table of 10, someone at that table has food insecurity issues, or they know someone who does. With, you know, the current state of affairs with people really living paycheck to paycheck, all it takes is, you know, someone getting hurt or ill or maybe even downsized through their job that really puts a financial impact on that family. And they need those extra resources in their community, like food pantries and soup kitchens.
We're talking about the need, particularly for children, for meals in the summer with the Eastern Illinois Food Bank and No Kid Hungry. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can join us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Again, that's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. We're at that handle, by the way. We've tweeted out some of the links for resources, those phone numbers, those websites. If you need information about these programs, that's all there, and we'll have that at our website also. Susie, I think when we're thinking about this whole notion of food insecurity, we've been talking about schools. You've been talking about the No Kid Hungry program. I wonder if you could just explain to us what your goals are with No Kid Hungry, and this is part of a nationwide campaign. What's the goal?
Sure thing. So No Kid Hungry works to ensure that every child in the United States has access to healthy food where they live, learn, and play. It began in 2008 and now has partnerships all across the country, including No Kid Hungry Illinois, of which I'm a part. We have three main strategies when we're trying to grow these federally funded nutrition programs. So Summer Meals is funded by the USDA, administered by the State Board of Education, and No Kid Hungry Illinois is proud to partner with and support this work to increase access to the food. So one of the things that Naomi mentioned is recruiting new sponsors and new sites. We support that work by going out into communities across the state and inviting nonprofits and schools, faith-based groups, and community leaders to talk about the program. Another thing that I mentioned a few minutes earlier was the program grants to provide support and expansion, innovative ideas to make sure that kids have access to these meals. And the third thing is really raising awareness. So thank you for sharing that website and the phone numbers out on your page.
And Teresa, you work with No Kid Hungry as well, and that's a little bit different from the school's program. Can you explain what Eastern Illinois Food Bank program does as well?
Absolutely. Eastern Illinois Food Bank, we service 17 counties here in Central Illinois, anywhere from soup kitchens to food pantries. We also do mobile pantry distribution, and we're partners with Feeding Our Kids here locally that do a backpack distribution, which you touched on earlier. So our job at the food bank is to make sure that all of these agency partners have the support and the resources and the food that they need to get it out into the community to help these individuals.
Where do you see the biggest gaps in the summer for need?
Biggest gaps, rural areas. Many of these students are already being bused maybe 20 or 30 minutes every day. So to be able to get access to food, it's not a walk down the street or a walk to, you know, that's nearby. And then if parents also have transportation issues, it does present a big gap in the rural areas.
Susie, how is No Kid Hungry trying to fill those gaps? You mentioned there were some mobile things. You mentioned there were other ways you'd like to see. I wonder what are other alternative ways of helping children have access to food apart from what we've already talked about?
A big part of the No Kid Hungry campaign has been advocating for changes in the federal law. So currently, the Child Nutrition Reauthorization Bill that Naomi mentioned is in progress. There are versions in the Senate, there are versions on the House, and the things that we really advocate for are creating flexibility. Kind of the gold standard in a meal program is something that not only provides a healthy meal, but also provides academic enrichment and physical activity. But if we have to choose between a perfect program or no meal at all, we're always going to choose providing a meal. So increasing flexibility in that congregate meal requirement, and also currently organizations can only serve two meals per day, whereas we know that many households have kids in childcare programs up to 12 hours. And that limitation on only being able to serve two meals a day, it really hurts them.
Susie, can you explain the history? I don't know, this is a complicated question, but sort of the history of the USDA and this congregant requirement that there have to be meals served to a big group in one location?
Well, I will do my best.
Yeah, so I know it's a complicated issue. Right.
The congregate meal requirement, the idea behind it is that you would bring kids together in a safe location that's supervised and like I said, kind of that gold standard model. When it was created in the 1960s, the program is now 40 years old. It was a lot easier to have community centers. Poverty was much more focused in densely populated urban areas. But as Teresa mentioned, it's so much more prevalent in urban areas now. So the regulations just don't match our current reality. And we want to make sure that every kid has access to a healthy meal.
Right, in rural areas as well now. Teresa, I wonder how you've been working for this at this problem for a very long time. I wonder, in an ideal world, how you'd like to see particularly this problem, if we've been talking about with children, what would be the best way you all would like to see this issue be addressed?
Wow, that is such a loaded question. I think I speak on behalf of everyone that my best day will be if I get to come into work and they say, it's done. There's no one hungry anymore. You can go home. The reality of the situation, unfortunately, is that it's growing every day. What we would love to see is, you know, it's been touched on earlier in the segment, you know, community involvement, but getting back to those individuals, you know, taking care of your neighbors and reaching out. If you know someone that needs a ride, get that person there. And I know it sounds so fundamental and, you know, maybe even a little naive, but we really just need to group together. You know, we were talking about Peoria and how they came together. Livingston County and Pontiac, they did the same thing for their community and for their students this summer by doing some summer feeding sites. So if we can all just have that conversation at a table, not one person can feed and take care of everyone. But if we all work together and do a small part, I think it would really come together.
So when we're thinking about this, Teresa, when we're thinking about different municipalities that may be tuning in and what they can learn from the examples, as you said, from Livingston and Peoria, first of all, who needs to be at that table to have that conversation, to convene? Because I think part of this problem is that it almost seems like there's really no one who has ownership of this problem in the summer. So who are the stakeholders who need to be at the table for communities? Does it need to be politicians as well as, it sounds like, part of the faith community as well as social service agencies?
It's nice if all of those individuals can come together. They all play a key part, whether it's a politician for, you know, maybe there's a zoning thing, the schools so that there's a great site, social services so that there is, you know, an enrichment activity or, you know, other services that are provided with the meals. If everyone comes to the table, again, with an open mind, I think they all realize that they have a part to play and not everyone has to carry the whole burden on their own.
Susie, what other partners would you like to see at the table when we're talking about particularly rural areas, maybe areas where you all are also working on challenges throughout the state trying to reach particularly these at least 28 counties that don't have any official summer school programs? Who else would you like to see at the table taking part in this conversation?
You know, we'd absolutely love to see local elected officials get involved. We've had a few examples where we've had an alderman or a state representative actually host a summer meal site. And even if an elected official isn't sponsoring or hosting a summer meal site, they're great conveners to get groups together. And like Teresa was saying, pulling together all the different organizations and individuals that can contribute and make sure that kids have access to healthy meals.
Teresa, when you said community partners, who particular community organizations, what community organizations would you like to see also involved with this?
You know, I think the sky's the limit. There's really no one that wouldn't be welcome at a roundtable like this, in my opinion.
Who are your partners right now? Who do you guys work with?
Right now, we have 220 agency partners, and everyone from Daily Bread Soup Kitchen, Champaign-Urbana Public Health, churches. We have a wide variety of partners across the state.
And when you do, for example, the backpack programs, how does that get distributed, and what partners do you work with for that?
We work with Feeding Our Kids, and they are one of our agency partners. They do a phenomenal job here in East Central Illinois in making sure that these kids are getting not only a meal for themselves, but this great, you know, pack of food that they take home. And most of these kids are not just eating this themselves. They're sharing it with their siblings. Sometimes even this food is going into the family pantry to help that family meet the gap over the weekend.
One question I wanted to ask both of you, it's really difficult to have a conversation about this now without looking at the context of the state budget situation that we're in. And we know there have been some social service agencies have suffered some really deep cuts and had problems. Susie, I wanted to start by asking you, with No Kid Hungry, has the Illinois state budget situation affected this campaign and this work that you all have been trying to do?
Absolutely. One of the biggest ways that it's impacted our work is sponsors and organizations that we partner with, if they haven't been able to meet their internal budget needs, they can't pay their bills, then they can't afford to feed the children in the summertime. So we've had programs that have had to cut back and programs that have had to close completely.
Teresa, how about you guys? Have you seen the state budget situation affecting your partner agencies?
Absolutely. When they're not able to, as she mentioned, get their bills paid, that's reduction in staff many times, or they're having to lay off the staff. So if you don't have the staff to execute the programs, then it really does trickle down from everything from maybe they've gone to serving two meals a day instead of three. Or if it's an after-school program, if there's no one there to staff it, that program has gone away. So we're taking these at-risk kids that are already relying on this program, we're taking it away, and we're putting this vulnerable population into quite possibly a position where they might have to make some really bad choices just to get, you know, that food on the table or to be fed. And that's just not acceptable.
Susie, would you say that you think this summer is then even more challenging than last summer, given the current fiscal climate that we're in?
I would say so. We always try to be optimists and say that we're going to grow. You know, last year, we served 6.7 million meals across the state. And this year, we want to serve more than 7 million meals to children in Illinois, but it will be a challenge.
Susie, what kind of partners are you looking for nationally? If there are different organizations tuning in, is it too late for them to get in touch with you for the summer?
Not at all. Sites can be added almost at any time over the summer. So again, those libraries, hospitals, community centers, if you're a nonprofit organization that's interested in serving meals, they can reach out to me at No Kid Hungry or also directly to the State Board of Education.
Teresa, I think probably other folks who are tuning in right now might be feeling a little discouraged by this and thinking, I'm not part of a social service agency. What can I do? I wonder, for your food bank, do you accept personal donations? Do you want cash donations? If someone wants to get involved and help at an individual level, how could they do that with the Eastern Illinois Food Bank?
The best way to find out how to get involved on all levels, eifoodbank.org is our website. They have volunteer opportunities that we have listed on our website. As far as donations, you know, we take everything, but cash really is one thing that goes so far. $1 donated to the food bank, we can stretch into $10 just from our buying power and our purchase power. Volunteers are always needed, also at the food bank and at our pantry locations. And you can also go and volunteer at one of our mobile food pantries that happen on the weekdays and on the weekends. That's on our website as well.
Do farmers also contribute to your program?
Absolutely. We have great partnerships here locally with Land Connection and the Urbana Farmers Market, who donate all of their Saturday and Tuesday end of market produce to our agency partners. Sola Gracia Farms in Urbana is a great supporter of ours, and they grow some items specifically for the food bank to help us keep that produce, because we all want that healthy, nutritious produce going out.
Thanks so much for joining me. Teresa Brown is the partnership manager at Eastern Illinois Food Bank. All of those resources she mentioned, we'll tweet out. They'll also be on our website. So if you follow 21st Show on Twitter, if you go to 21stshow.org, we'll have all of that information. I want to thank Susie Lee joining us as well, the programs manager for No Kid Hungry. Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. On Sunday, a Southern Indiana man, James Wesley Howell, was arrested in Santa Monica, California. It's reported he told police he was on his way to a gay pride event in Los Angeles when he was discovered with three assault rifles, high-capacity magazines, ammunition, and a five-gallon bucket with chemicals capable of forming explosive devices that were in his car. He's now being held in jail on a $500,000 bond. His initial court hearing was scheduled for this morning. Joining us to learn more about this is Jill Jesus. She's a reporter at the Indianapolis Star and has been covering this. Jill, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You interviewed James Howell's ex-boyfriend. What did he say about him?
We talked to him. He said that he was not entirely surprised about what had happened. This is a boyfriend that had been with Mr. Howell around last October, said that he was a collector of various types of firearms, had been somewhat violent toward him. But I will say that nobody that we spoke to, including the ex-boyfriend and various other friends and acquaintances who knew Howell in southern Indiana, said that there was anything, that he harbored any ill feelings toward the LGBT community. This is somebody who was gay himself. But they did say that he had some violent tendencies and that he had been acting violent toward, at the very least, some friends or associates that he knew in the area.
And today we are seeing the news that while in Indiana, he was put on probation, ordered by a judge to turn over his weapons, and actually, I think, was not even supposed to have left the state. So do we know what happened?
Right. So that's all stemming back from some incidents in October 2015. There was a report that he had pointed a firearm at a neighbor. He was arrested, and he ended up pleading guilty in April to a misdemeanor intimidation charge. And so those requirements were set out as part of his sentencing in connection to that case. So, yeah, he was not supposed to have any firearms with him. And I do believe he was not supposed to leave the state. So that all stems from that. He had another pending case that was actually based out of Louisville. The town that he was from was just across the river in Indiana from Louisville. And so this other case was a pending reckless driving and fleeing police case that I suppose happened in February of this year. So he did have some criminal history here, wasn't supposed to have any firearms, and again had a pending case in Louisville.
And Jill, do we know why officials didn't check that he turned over his weapons? Is it even standard that when a judge orders this, does anyone follow up?
I don't have a whole lot of information about that. That's something that we're still trying to explore. So just that we just know that it was part of the terms of his probation, but we're not entirely clear at this moment what sort of follow-up was involved in ensuring that he was following those terms.
And obviously, I think this news of this happened in the middle of the situation in Orlando, the Pulse nightclub shooting, the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history, that was also at a gay nightclub. So there's questions about how much the LGBT community was targeted there. But just to be clear, I don't think people are aware that James Wesley Howell, so you're saying that his ex-boyfriend, he is gay, he is openly gay, and is it clear that he wasn't expressing a threat, or do we know what he said to police about whether or not he was saying anything about threatening the community?
So this is where it is a little bit complicated. Initially, Santa Monica police had said that he made comments toward police officers when he was stopped there, that he had intended to go to the Pride Parade in Los Angeles and inflict some type of harm. But they really walked that back later Sunday and said that, no, that was completely incorrect. He didn't make those types of comments. He had merely stated that he was on his way to the Pride Parade. And again, those who knew him in southern Indiana said that he was not at all, he'd never said anything violent toward the LGBT community in particular. And so that's something that we're still sort of trying to parse through. But Right. Initial reports that he had said anything about harming anybody at this Pride parade in Los Angeles were later found to be incorrect.
Yeah. So it sounds like it's as always with these situations, it's a complicated one and the initial reports may not have been correct. What's next for James Wesley Howell? He's in court in California this morning.
Yes, he has an arraignment in California this morning. What I last heard from the FBI last night in Los Angeles was that they're still trying to determine what sort of charging may be applied here. I know there was some discussion about state charges versus federal charges. And so right now we're sort of waiting to see what happens with this arraignment hearing in California this morning.
And what's the reaction been, Jill, I guess in other parts of Indiana and throughout the state to this story? Because, and again, it's probably been a little bit overshadowed by the events in Orlando.
I certainly think that there's a lot of interest that's expressed in this case, but at the same time, I think that people are still trying to sort of wait and see and figure out what exactly is going on here, because it is a very complicated case. We've certainly, obviously learned that things are a bit different from what was initially reported by police early Sunday. So it's sort of like a lot of interest, but also a bit of a want to sort of wait and see what happens here.
And lots more reporting you're going to be doing on this as well, I imagine.
Right.
Thanks for joining us. That's Jill Desis. She's a reporter with the Indianapolis Star. Thanks, Jill.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The Federal Freedom of Information Act is about to hit 50 years old this July, and an update to it was just sent to President Obama's desk yesterday. That's because Congress has approved a change to the law. FOIAs give citizens and news organizations access to a wide range of public records. Joining us now is one of the groups that worked to get Congress to change these things. RTDNA is the Radio Television Digital News Association. Illinois native Mike Cavender is its executive director. He's on the line with us right now from Atlanta. Hey, Mike, welcome to the 21st, and welcome back to Illinois, at least to the airwaves.
Thank you, Nyla. Glad to be with you.
Maybe you can explain what FOIA requests are for folks who aren't familiar, Mike.
Sure, and I should point out that this legislation that was passed by the House last night is one of the most significant pieces of freedom of information legislation ever passed since the Act was first enacted 50 years ago. But essentially, FOIA allows anyone, a journalist, a citizen, anyone who wants information about a given subject to request it from the federal government. And it's really the very basis of transparency within the government, the ability to have at your disposal this information. And this FOI Improvement Act, as it's called, goes a long way toward codifying that.
When you say it's significant, maybe you can explain what's in the legislation and why you think it's so significant.
Sure. To boil it down in a nutshell, essentially, this places the burden on federal government agencies themselves to justify why they would withhold information instead of placing that same burden on the individual or individuals who request it to justify its release. And that's a very, very significant point. So you need to tell me, if you're a government agency, why I can't have this information, as opposed to me telling you why I want it.
And I know this update is also going to call for a centralized online portal where people can make requests for a public record. I know that already exists. Is this going to update it? It also sounds like it's also a technological update as well as a bit of a philosophical change that you're talking about.
Well, absolutely a technological update, to be sure, because the federal government, as you know from other aspects of government, is not the most technologically savvy. And this mandates improvements in that, which will make, therefore, improvements in the ability to request this information and receive it easier and more efficient. So that's an important part, too. But again, it's the really, really significant part is that it places the burden of proof on the government, not the individual.
Now, there were lots of different iterations of this that were trying to get passed. Last year, there was an effort that fell short. What do you think was the change this time, and why was it so hard for this to pass both houses of Congress?
Well, and this, I should point out, has been years in the making, and as you have indicated, there have been other attempts at it, and it has failed in one form or fashion. It's typical with any legislation that there are groups, in this case certain agencies within the government, that objected to, frankly, making the process easier or having fewer restrictions on the process. And that lobbying by those individuals and those groups was sufficient enough to always delay action on similar bills. Finally, the headwinds just became too strong, and this bill received bipartisan approval in both the Senate and the House.
So now the big question is, this bill now has been sent to President Obama. Do we have a sense of whether or not he's going to sign this bill?
Yes, we have indications that he will sign the bill. Those were publicized this morning, and this bill just passed last night. And we now expect him to sign it. So it then would become the law of the land.
Well, and as we think about that, I mean, as we think about transparency in this administration, I wonder if RTDNA has a sense of transparency during the Obama administration versus previous administrations.
Well, and we have written about this and about this extensively. Frankly, the Obama administration has not been particularly transparent, despite the president's promises during his first campaign that he would make his administration the most transparent in history. That has just simply not been borne out, and for a variety of reasons. And we have called on the government repeatedly and the Obama administration to open up their lines of communication, but it's been a difficult struggle, and so we're hopeful that at least in the waning months of the Obama administration, this will improve the process.
Well, I mean, on that note, on a related note, there will be a new president who will not be Barack Obama soon. And there was news yesterday about one of those possible candidates, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump, revoking the Washington Post press credentials. This is sort of the Washington Post now joins a whole slew of other news organizations, whether we're talking about Univision or the Huffington Post, who at one point or another, the Trump campaign has revoked their press credentials. You blogged about this morning. I guess we should start with, what does RTDNA think about this issue of a presidential candidate revoking press credentials? Is this unprecedented?
Well, I can't say for certain that it is unprecedented. It is highly unusual at the very least. And I think it's a clear indication that this candidate, frankly, is pretty thin-skinned when it comes to articles and stories that are reported about him and his organization that he, frankly, is not pleased with and does not like. And he's lashed out against reporters. He's called them sleazy. He's called them inaccurate and libelous. And I have never, in all the time that I have been covering politics, a lot of years, frankly, I have never seen anything like this, and I don't think others have either. And so if it were not such a serious matter, I would say it's simply silly to withhold press credentials, because that's not going to stop the Washington Post any more than it'll stop Politico or any other news organization that's been similarly sanctioned from reporting on one of the most important stories we have in the country. So it's just a folly in our judgment.
Mike Cavender is the executive director of RTDNA, joining us from Atlanta. Mike, thanks for being with us on the 21st.
Thank you very much.
We talked about a lot of things on the 21st today, provided a lot of resources for people. If you want those links, particularly about summer programs for children, for school children, how to get involved, whether as a provider or for donations, you can go to our website. That's www.21stshow.org. There at that website, 21stshow.org, you'll have all the ways to contact us. You can find all of our accounts, where there's Facebook or Twitter, and how to follow us there. That's where you'll find our email and our phone number to leave us voicemails and give us feedback. We love that feedback, by the way. You can always do that by going to 21stshow.org. To find past shows, if you have the NPR One app, search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Androids. All of those links, again, on our website. We're produced by Christine Herman, Ben Thomas Payne, and Travis Stansel. Technical direction today comes from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.